before we begin, can you make sure your cell phones are off? And that, please avoid any texting.
And music.
And music, yeah. Good morning, dear hearts, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophy here in Philadelphia. This morning we have a little panel going, and we're going to be discussing Kuan Yin and the Kuan Yin Pledge. But before we begin that, I'd like to do the declaration of this lodge and the announcements for today and this month. We'll do the declaration first. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the truer and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate these ideas among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Well, this lodge is one of approximately 30 situated around the world. And the one commonality we all have is that we're loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement. And by loyal, we mean that we present, and all the lodges present, the true writings of the founders of the philosophy of theosophy, their true writings and true teachings. Our part in doing that is meetings on Sunday as today. And that meeting occurs at 11 o'clock. It ends at 12 sharp. The doors open at 10:30. We also have a meeting on Wednesdays. And beginning at 5:30, the doors open, and there is a library in the front of the building available for public use. And that library is a reference library, not a lending library. And it goes from 5:30 to 7:30. 7:30, the library closes. There's a 15-minute respite, and then at 7:45, a Wednesday meeting begins. It goes from 7:15 until 9:00. At that meeting, we are studying The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. Presently, we are in Chapter 9, and we are studying arguments for and against reincarnation. The Sunday meetings, this is the last one in January. February begins a new umbrella topic, and that would be comparative religions and spiritual growth. And the first meeting would be February 5th, and it is entitled Responsibility Begins with Self-Reliance. Right behind this room, there's a little table, and on that table are these programs. And please pick one up. It'll keep you informed of everything that we do during the next couple months. There's a special meeting in March, the 21st, and that's to honor a great theosophist, William Q. Judge. I guess that takes care of the... Oh, that's a positive. Okay. After this meeting, there's a card available at the desk, which is right behind this room, and it's a book table, and books are available for your purchase, and they are at cost. Everything this lodge does is at cost to the students, and that's because everything, all knowledge is our spiritual birthright. No profit is made. So you can purchase anything you like, straight line theosophical teachings. I think that's about it. Now, this morning, as mentioned, we're going to take up the topic of Kuan Yin and her pledge. To begin with, we're going to take a look at Kuan Yin. And then we'll take a look. The second speaker will discuss the pledge of Kuan Yin. Okay, few could ever deny that the integration of Buddhism into China was in great part caused by one person, a sweet diminutive woman with a sweet and merciful disposition. She not only won the hearts of the Chinese, but profoundly affected even those belonging to many other foreign traditions. Kuan Yin is the Bodhisattva of compassion, revered by the Buddhists as the goddess of mercy. This divine woman is the beloved goddess of over 1 billion people the world over. So where did this person come from? Historically, there was a Mahayana Buddhist by the name of Avalokiteshvara. He was of Indian, Indian ancestry. And in Indian scriptures, he became known also as Quan Shi Yin, which is masculine. The feminine is Kuan Yin. All over China, and Thailand, Korea, Japan, and other countries in that area, she has a different name. In Japan, for instance, her name is Kuan Yin. China prefers Kuan Yin. India, it's still Avalokiteshvara. All, however, carry the same meaning. And that meaning is the Lord who is seen or heard from below, implying the manifest appearance of a spiritual energy or the divine self perceived by the human self. Early Hindu literature characterized this spiritual divine energy as a Lord or Bodhisattva. Teachings about Avalokiteshvara were introduced into China during the first century of the era as part of this modern era, as part of Buddhist doctrine, and into Tibet in the 7th century. Both nations took the Bodhisattva ideal to their hearts. The Tibetans considered Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, to be not only the earthly representative of Buddha, but also the chief guardian of their sacred doctrine. The Chinese, however, had a hard time personifying as a man the quality of love exemplified by the mother and child relationship. So they changed Avalokiteshvara into a woman. This took place gradually, and by the 7th century, Kuan Yin was referred to as the mother of 10 million Buddhas. The idea being that from the feminine qualities of purity, compassion, and the highest wisdom, Buddhas are born. By the 11th century, the goddess figure had become so popular that it all but obliterated the male representation. Bodhi means wisdom or enlightenment. Sattva means being or essence. Put the two together and you have Bodhisattva, a being who is enlightened and ready to transcend the cycles of birth, death, and rebirth. Kuan Yin is worshipped especially by women. She comforts the troubled, the sick, the lost, the senile, and the unfortunate. Her popularity has grown such throughout the centuries. She is now regarded as the protector of all seafarers, farmers, and travelers. There are temples all over China dedicated to Kuan Yin, this goddess, and she is worshipped by women on the 19th day of the 2nd, 6th, and 9th moons of the Chinese lunar calendar. In Korea, they place statues of Kuan Yin in places where people going to work can see the statues to remind them to do merciful deeds and good deeds at work, on the way to work, on the way home from work. To paraphrase an 11th century poet named Song Tong Pu, Kuan Yin does not come here and I don't go there. The water is in the basin and the moon is in the sky. When the water is clear and the moon appears, and when our mind is bright, an image emerges. This image, our awakened self nature, is what sages call Kuan Yin. For when our self nature is awakened, and compassion active, we are Kuan Yin, the incarnation of mercy and love.
The pledge itself. Never will I seek nor receive private, individual salvation. Never will I enter into final peace alone, but forever and everywhere will I live and strive for the redemption of every creature throughout the world. Now we think most human beings are moved by such a pledge, such a vow. And we may feel, I would want to do that. But it isn't what we think. Mahatma Gandhi said a vow was a right angle. The minute you take it, you are headed in a completely different direction. It is something serious, spiritual, and consuming in the sense that it takes your energy and puts it in a different place, in a more real place within yourself. So it isn't something to do lightly, but before we can do anything, we have to do it intellectually. We have to understand what is a bodhisattva, what is a bodhisattva pledge, what is things or promises or vows that I could do now that could lead me to this point. And for those of us here who are already students of HPB, what we're talking about is the second fragment of the Voice of the Silence, which teaches the difference between liberation and renunciation, or the doctrine of the I versus the doctrine of the heart. What are we willing to do to truly help humanity and life? The bodhisattva, as was described, is an individual, male or female, who makes that vow, determines to put life ahead of self, to put service ahead of anything else. And that service, of course, is spiritual. Two things that have to be realized by that individual. One, this is not an ordinary promise, but will consume lifetimes. Actually, the rest of one's lifetimes. And second, that you're making to a pledge to something higher within yourself and within all of life. We found two wonderful statements, one about the Buddhist Diamond Sutra. It tells us that while the bodhisattva vows to save every being, the bodhisattva at the same time recognizes that there are no beings to be saved. Everything that anyone can do to be of service, to gain wisdom and share it with another, is the method of life. We know ourselves. Everything we know, we learned from someone else. Either their written word, their spoken instructions to us, or their example. We haven't done anything on our own except imitate where we choose. And that is the whole principle of sharing and education and knowledge. We see, we recognize, we honor, we use. And that is the process of life and growth. Which means, in our own little way, every one of us is a bodhisattva. And we have been doing sharing this with family, friends, perhaps co-workers. We've been using this. We just haven't committed to it. Another interesting thing we read, the bodhisattva sees the thread that unites all consciousness and hence all being into one universal mind, and then realizes that all manifestation is a sacrifice. All of it. We, as reincarnating egos, as thinkers, incarnate to elevate, to use, impress, and elevate lower life, as well as to share and be and learn from each other. Lower life is here just for us to be able to do that and to be available itself for that higher impress. All of manifestation is a sacrifice. The next time you go out and look at the sky, move away from the city first and see the stars and the planets. In that moment of awe where you realize your puniness and pettiness, realize everything you're seeing is a sacrifice, is a manifestation, and you are neither puny nor petty because you are a perceiver. And if you can perceive it, it has to be a part of you already. You're not small at all. So the bodhisattvas understand that sacrifice and compassion are two sides of one and the same thing. Sacrifice and compassion, they are the same, like spirit and matter. So in the maya of everything that we see, we begin to realize karma itself, the natural, just reaction or result of an action, is compassion and justice. When the bodhisattva takes this pledge and renounces nirvana or bliss, absorption in what is natural to the spiritual being, our natural state is one of bliss, but we have sacrificed it to come here and do this work. And when the bodhisattva sacrifices that goal, that when they achieve enlightenment, rather than accepting that bliss, which is the result of that great effort, they will instead remain to help, teach, instruct, share, even if it's only with one other soul, that in sacrificing their liberation, they are bound in compassion with all of life. If you could talk to a bodhisattva, they wouldn't understand why you would question it. For a bodhisattva knows that the method of achieving that kind of wisdom and enlightenment depended on the compassion of those who had that wisdom already. It is a chain that never ends. And we see it manifested here in life. You have a teacher, you have a student. The student becomes a teacher and has a student. It's a never-ending chain of passing on what is known and understood. But the bodhisattva does suffer. Wouldn't call it suffering like we do. First, because if that bodhisattva is to work with humanity, it must have a form. And there isn't a form that can allow that bodhisattva to contain all that wisdom and power while it is he or she is here. Therefore, they are limited by the form. And it must, if not be suffering, a kind of frustration. But there is a very definite kind of suffering, and that's one that we all experience with family or friends. We see someone stupidly going through something, and no matter how much advice you might give, how much knowledge you might have, you can't prevent them from their own stupidity. They are going to go through it because they're choosing without realizing that that's what they're doing. Well, the bodhisattva has to see humanity being stupid and cruel and vicious, knowing that it could be stopped if they chose to stop it. Not the bodhisattvas, if the individuals involved chose to stop it. But no wise being will interfere with the karma of another or of nations. Things must play out because that's how we learn from them. So there is that kind of suffering that must be intense. If we know we feel it with our children and our friends, imagine if you're watching millions suffer, knowing they don't have to. Other vow a bodhisattva might take, and you'll find hundreds of them, each one more beautiful than the other, but we don't think anything comes close to the Kuan Yin pledge. And we do have these for sale for $1 at our book table. Another resolve: I take upon myself the burden of all suffering. I am resolved to do so. I will endure it. I do not turn or run away, do not tremble, am not terrified nor afraid, do not turn back or despond. Of course a bodhisattva is not going to despond. When you know that all life is one, from the Buddha down to the lowest thing you can imagine, all life is one, and all humans are self-willed, can choose and unchoose, make and remake their own conditions. Of course, you're not going to despond. And perhaps shrug would be a better thing. We might even try it with ourselves. If we feel despondent about what we've done or about a condition we find for ourselves, shrug instead and say, oh, that's what I chose. I can choose better. The Mahayana Buddhism teaches the ideal of bodhisattva, that compassion for all beings is natural to all souls. So how do we start here and now where we are? What can we do? We found these suggestions. Renounce an envious, angry, proud, deceitful, or false mind. Just renounce it. You find it in yourself, renounce it. Ever do upright deeds. Disparage no one. Never argue over the law. And the Gita, it's said, as unto thee who findeth no fault. The law brought you what you have. Do not argue. You caused it, you can fix it. Never cause others doubts or regret, but be gentle, patient, and compassionate. And then we were thinking that one wonderful example of seeing this never will I seek nor receive private individual salvation in action is at the end of the Mahabharata, that incredible Hindu epic that has the Bhagavad Gita as a little tiny chapter of it, in which the head of the Pandu clan was about to enter heaven, and he was stopped. And they said, you can't bring your dog in here. And his reply was, well, then it wouldn't be heaven to me. I'm not going. And that, of course, in the tale is when the god then not only opened heaven, but opened the understanding that it was just a test. Of course he can bring the dog. Of course he can bring everything he loves. And of course his compassion is the very thing that they were searching for. And we're sure you have questions. Maybe not. Oh.
Well, the bodhisattva, it seems like the suffering of the bodhisattva is not their own suffering, but that for humanity which keeps making
stupid
mistakes. And I'm sure we've all known people that we love that we figure, why don't they just get it? Why can't they stop this behavior? It's self-destructive, it's alienating themselves from others, and it seems to end in ruin and annihilation, but we shouldn't make that judgment, really.
Well, it couldn't end in annihilation. One of the things we are taught in theosophy is that no matter how low it appears that someone sinks, that is like their workbook, their vehicle, and that will get destroyed, return to nature. But the thinker who allowed that to happen will remain in complete integrity with all of the seeds of what they created and will literally have to drop out until the next great period of evolution. So there is no annihilation in that sense. What you lose is all the work you have done, good, bad, or indifferent. But the bodhisattva does suffer in the same way we suffer watching a friend. I mean, we realize we can't do anything, but we definitely feel the pain, and we may equally do stupid things to try to prevent them from going further. Okay, yes.
In regarding to the bodhisattva not being able to do anything in spite of wanting to help humanity, that may be true that they can't help, but in terms of not being able to do anything, mm-hmm. It is said that by their combined efforts, they form a guardian mm-hmm. wall. So what does that accomplish? What do they accomplish by doing that?
What do those wise ones accomplish by forming a guardian wall, a wall of protection? It actually says that, and we may all find this difficult to conceive, that they are holding back some of the karma from our days in Atlantis when we were totally, most of us, selfish and creating really horrible, huge causes that we have not yet seen the results. So they are able to hold back some of the larger forces and piece them out. There is also the atmosphere of hope and light and wisdom that individuals may touch upon in a dark moment, realizing there is hope, there is spiritual wisdom to be had. There is also, of course, the incarnation of many beings that have committed to paper and given hope directly to individuals through parables and myths and the spiritual writings that we have. You had your hand?
I'm finished. Okay. Back to the first contribution, we imagine that if we are watching a friend or a loved one suffer with something and we have a hard time understanding why they can't conquer it, it's probably something we've already conquered. But we can, that's where the compassion aspect comes in, because if we can't figure out why they can't do it, then we have some past experience here. We must have, what we need to remember is we suffered the same way, and therefore it should be the key that unlocks our compassion. Oh, this is something I already experienced. I've given as much help as I can. Maybe I just need to be here for them when they need me.
Yeah, I believe also that the guardian wall limits the amount, as was said by the other commentator. It's like the saying that you only get as much as you can handle. The guardian wall is what does that.
You know, we should also be able to be compassionate, because we should also be able to see moments when we weren't able to stop what we were doing, no matter what everybody said to us. That kind of necessity to keep doing something until you fall flat on your face, and then you're willing to pick yourself up and learn. It takes time to realize you don't have to be a disaster in order to start repairing. You can just be a mess and start repairing. Yes?
There are very few symbols in ancient teachings with women as representation of it.
But we wonder whose fault that would be.
We'll take responsibility.
Good.
But Isis is one of the one figure that there's a book out there called Isis Unveiled, mm-hmm. but it's that intrigues us who Isis was, and we know that this was the Garden of Light and of the harbor of sailors, and we know that the Statue of Liberty is modeled after Isis. And we are wondering, is this a theme that runs through these goddess ideas?
Mm-hmm. They're in our reference library, there's a book called Heroines and Goddesses. And in that book, there is a list, alphabetical, of I didn't count them, of course, but there's got to be at least 250 or more women, goddesses, heroines. So they're not neglected. They're there in history. They just didn't get the press that the men got, I guess. But in that book, it lists them all. Quan Yin is in there. Quan Shi Lin is in there, or Yin is in there. Isis is in there. Tara, many, many of them. So they are in history, myths and legends. But you have to look for them a lot harder than you did for men.
One of the quotes we have always enjoyed was a student within the philosophy. When asked why the adepts, the Mahatmas, are usually depicted as male, weren't there female adepts? And the response was, well, of course, but men need the example more. Which, but in a way, this is true, because it's difficult in our society for a man to show compassion, to show that kind of responsiveness. They're considered weak or feminine, or there's something wrong with them that they don't have their own nature more in control. We bring up boys and young men that way to be strong and deny that sort of side of their nature. So. But we did also want to say, in reality, the book Isis Unveiled by H.P. Blavatsky is misnamed. She wrote it under the title Isis Veiled, and the title was already taken. So the publisher gave it a new title, Isis Unveiled. She didn't have the money to go through any sort of changes and let it go that way. But if you open the book, you know how the title's always on, is it on the left page? It says Isis Veiled. It doesn't say Isis Unveiled. She couldn't pay to have any changes, but we think it's very important to realize that she did not try to unveil Isis to us. We have to unveil both sides, the male and the female side, within our own consciousness, and she did not publish the whole of the secret doctrine, and she said that as well. That's the effort and work that we must do. Yes?
One of the practical applications of compassion is said is to step out of the sunlight into the shade to make more room for others. And one of the tasks of the disciple is to appear as nothing in the eyes of another. So perhaps it is not by coincidence that the female goddesses representing compassion, the heroines, demonstrate that wisdom by being in the background.
Do you want to comment on that? Oh, well, you don't want me to, I'm sure. Sometimes one is in the background out of gentleness and compassion, and sometimes it's because the other has pushed you aside. So we have to look historically. We have to be absolutely certain that we're not acting on those kind of prejudices and misbehavior ourselves. We have to make that kind of pledge within ourselves. I will judge by actions, not by gender, not by what group someone belongs to, not by how they're dressed. I will judge by actions, and I will respond in that manner. And that's showing true compassion. Yes.
We got on an elevator recently, and a young man got on in front of me with the hat on crooked, the hoodie, you know, the whole, you know, everything that the young men are wearing now with the pants.
To
on.
Be different, and yet they're all alike. Yes.
And, you know, I immediately had a negative attitude, but the doors were just about to close, and he rushed forward, pushed the door back, gave me a gigantic smile, and I said, well, thank you. And I felt so guilty that I had made this judgment, you know, on first impressions, right, when I hadn't even talked to this young man.
Yeah, rushing to judgment gets us all. We all do the same exact thing you did. And that's intolerable. That's why we feel guilty. It's an old adage, don't judge a book by its cover. And it's said a million different ways throughout time. But it's something that's very, very difficult to overcome.
Except that guilt that you felt is the ember that can light the fire that will overcome it. Instead of going, oh, I feel just terrible that I did that, and moving on to the next event, write it down. Here's what I did. How stupid that was. I'm going to investigate why I did it. What movies have I seen? What news did I watch that led me to believe this and this equals this? I mean, mathematically, I'm an idiot. I want to figure out how I did this stupid math. And that guilt is a wonderful, wonderful tool to get you started in doing it. And it has to be done. We are walking blocks of prejudice, some from past lives we've brought over with us, some from the way our family feels, the way our religion feels. We have to inspect all of it. We can't just trust it. We've never examined our own heritage. Yes.
But in feeling guilty for ourselves, condemning ourselves for what we've done, aren't we not exerting the same harsh punishment on ourselves and judgment that we did for the other?
Fine. Good. We deserve it. We don't know that the other deserves it. That's the problem. Nobody knows better than I do that I deserve it. So we shouldn't walk around with guilt because it's consuming. We should examine it and use it.
Yeah, you don't need to go out and buy a bigger club. The one you have is big enough. But if you recognize that you did it and that you feel guilty about it, don't keep beating yourself up. Take positive steps to overcome.
Yes.
It would seem that in that very serious, very dark, I accept this guilt, I am such a sinner, there's an attachment to that that reinforces that negativity, isn't there? Is there any sense of joy or invigorating a cause in lightness in this pledge?
Well, this pledge is all lightness. It says, I honestly see and know that I am one with all of life. I am one with space. I am one with the lowest and the highest thing. That is nothing but joy. So it isn't this pledge that has any guilt or downward tendency. It's our own response to witnessing our own action that was so much less than we know it could be. There's no sense of being a sinner. Am I a sinner when I make a mistake in math? No. I don't understand how to do the math. There's no sin involved. I would feel guilty if I claimed to have studied it and then couldn't do it. So there's no sin or sinner in this. There is just, I will use these things, these events that point to me that I am out of line as stepping stones to learning how to do the math.
The pledge says that. The pledge gives us a truer realization of the self and a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. That's what it says.
Yes.
Regarding...
The gentleman in front of you first.
Well, we just seem that the word attachment keeps on coming up. You know, attached to despair, attached to guilt, attached to looking at ourselves and seeing, you know, whatever, either feeling good or bad. What are we attached to? Why just can't we let it go and make note of it and move on, rather than carrying it with us and saying, "Ooh, well, we're attached to it, so therefore we keep on dragging it around with ourselves." So I think it's in the Gita, just cut all attachments. You know, just do what needs to be done for that higher purpose, and let everything fall away, which is non-attachment. Which it's easy to express.
Yes, sort of. No, you did a very good job. The scissors that make that cut are difficult to find and then to use. What is it about attachment that makes it so hard?
Once you say attachment, you own it. It's yours now, and you have to get rid of it. Attachment, in the Gita, it says, don't be attached to the results. And the result of the elevator was guilt. And and once you get that guilt, it's yours until you can get rid of it some other way. But you got to take some positive steps in order to do that. Yes.
Well, can I give it away to you?
I've got my own attachments.
If we could stop and realize that we are attached to what we're attached to because we want to be, because we either liked it before and it's become a complete habit, or we refuse to look at it because we know it would be too much work to give up. There are people who will sneak a cigarette on their deathbed in the hospital, not only risking their life because they have lung cancer or something, or emphysema, but risking everybody else's life because they have an oxygen unit in their room. Now, that is maniacal, don't you agree? And yet we all have that kind of response to things we find and see and know in ourselves, that wanting is so much greater than the not wanting. It's like this study that we're all about, the search for wisdom. On the day we want wisdom more than peace of mind or leisure or whatever it is we're focused on that day we will begin becoming wise. So attachment is natural to us as thinkers, but the ability to detach is just as natural. We just don't want to.
The image of after making this vow or pledge that sets us up on a right angle from where we work. The plane of action that we're on, and we're thinking of the scissors too in a sense, or it's a right angle but coming down on us.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah,
and we need to make a cut with all those feelings of guilt of the past, because knowing the law, the effects will follow. So why worry about it? It might be in this life, it might be several, more likely it'll be in another life. Just set up better causes.
Yes.
And don't worry about the past or the feelings or the judgment that we make. You know, realize we're wrong, and then when we see the next person dressed like that we may have judged, we try to reach out to them and realize that dress is not the best indicator of character. It's, you know, sometimes the two fit, often they don't.
Yes.
Once again, regarding that idea of the making a pledge or a vow as a right angle, well, for many of us, that's about as impossible as stopping a train going 50 miles an hour making the right angle. That the forward motion,
right.
Of all our nature up to that point is going to perhaps carry us to make many mistakes and fall back a number of times. But isn't the vow that when we recognize that we will always keep trying to counteract it and move in the intended direction, even if we fail 100 times?
Yes, we are absolutely told the only failure is to stop trying. But when we're considering, resolutions are the same thing. It's a promise to yourself that we want to make a change about something. We are given several warnings. One, always make a positive resolution. Not, I am going to give up smoking, but I want to breathe clean air. Then if you reach for a cigarette, that's the opposite of what you have promised yourself. So you make positive resolutions. Second, you never make a resolution that you do not intend to keep. And many people do. They want their list to look good. You know, I've promised to give up all these things. That weakens your own will. Third, do things incrementally. You're not going to stop the speeding train. You can, however, begin applying the brakes to the speeding train. Look at yourself, your life, your attitude, your behaviors, and begin altering where you can in smaller ways. You know, the magic that we never realize, ever. You look at this body and brain, and you don't realize and appreciate it's the most amazing instrument on this panel? On this planet. It can self-lubricate, self-heal. We remember as children, we used to take knives and cut ourselves just to watch the blood coagulate and close itself, because it's incredible. The whole human body is a magic, responsive, self-controlling element, and we use it as though it were nothing. It's better than any speeding train or speeding computer. The very fact that we can see and hear and speak, it's pure magic. So take the magic that you have in the instrument that you have and work on ways to improve that. We just read about an artist who was in a horrible automobile accident. It split her brain in half, and they said she'd never come out of the coma, walk or talk. And her awesomeness was, wait a minute, I will use this instrument as I choose because I am the important part. It's my instrument. I will do it. And she, a few years later, felt she was being treated as a child because she was in a wheelchair, like people talking over her. And she said, okay, goodbye wheelchair, I'm going to walk. And walk she does, even though she can't. It's not possible, but she can. So we, without those constraints and difficulties, can begin to do the same thing. She's probably in her 60s now, and she just grew an inch the last year. It's not possible to do that either, but through exercise and effort, she was able to change the instrument. What's wrong with us? Do we need an automobile accident first? Yes. Yes.
So with respect to the vow, in terms of alleviating suffering, it seems to me that there's an endless kind of amount of suffering out there in the world. And I think if I were to kind of try to go out there and try to alleviate that, mm-hmm. it seems like that's a path to polluting myself. But whereas maybe if I just just focus on my own suffering and, you know, kind of cleaning up myself just through being an example, that would somehow be more productive in alleviating the suffering. I don't know, I haven't figured out a balance of trying to be productive in the world and alleviate the suffering of the world.
Right.
I think I need to work on my own in order to perhaps better do that.
One of the things the people in China made a mistake about was they thought that, initially they thought that Kuan Yin was a deity instead of a human being. And it's a human being that worked her whole life and life and life and life to become that bodhisattva. And it's when you start taking positive steps, incremental was mentioned, positive incremental steps of compassion, then you become a Kuan Yin yourself, a bodhisattva in the making by doing that. You're a human being, so was Kuan Yin. You have to take one step at a time, as she did.
You know, in your statement, what you indicated, you should do both. It isn't that I want to fix or get rid of my suffering, because I understand my suffering was caused by me, by my own choices, my own will. I'm not trying to escape that. I'm trying to understand how can I do better so I don't keep creating these conditions, which means working on yourself, understanding your motive, getting wisdom from those who have it so you can begin to apply those principles to yourself. Asking someone, how is it you're able to control your temper that way? What did you learn? What did you know? And investigating wherever we can. At the same time, sharing what we learn. Not imposing it on someone else, but making it available to others. Yes?
Well, this very idea, isn't that what theosophy, isn't that why we're all here? Because, I mean, we really want to change the world, but we can't because we're stuck with this person that we live with. And that when we come to theosophy, by changing our ideas, we begin to change our world. Because in the philosophy, it says that the universe evolves from within outward. So the analogy is that we are that universe. We are the microcosm of the micro macro. So from the ideas that we hold to be true, begin to manifest themselves. But it's sometimes it can happen in a moment, but sometimes it takes lifetimes. But by dwelling on these ideas and, as it was said, trying to be practical about them and apply them and to be them, we change. And our world becomes less sufferable, that we're able to suffer less and help others more.
Was it Churchill who said, never, 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 never give up? I mean, our problem isn't that we're defeated. It's that we accept defeat as the finality, when we should say, okay, what have I learned from that? And step up and start again from where you find yourself. You want to mention this?
Oh, sure. On the book table outside this room, there are these plastic cards with the Kuan Yin pledge and a picture of Kuan Yin with 1,000 arms. I don't know if you're all familiar with that, but when she was helping people, she couldn't do it fast enough to suit herself. And so she asked for more arms to help. And then she needed eyes so she could see more people to help. So if you look at this closely, or you look at a larger picture of it, which I would suggest, you'll see an eye on each of 1,000 hands so she can, I don't think purview is the right word, but she can peruse the entire world and see and help more and more people. This is on the table and it's free for your taking.
And also you can go on YouTube and see the the dance of the Chinese women producing what made this picture. It's exquisite, but nothing is more exquisite than this pledge itself. And we recommend seriously thinking about it. Meeting is adjourned.